I'm David Hughes. I'm the author of a new book called COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy. I'm currently a senior lecturer in international relations at the University of Lincoln.
So international relations, how does the COVID-19 relate to that? I would have thought that your job is more to do with geopolitics.
Well, what I argue in the book is that COVID-19, the so-called pandemic, was in fact the most comprehensive and ferocious psychological operation in history, waged against the populations of multiple countries transnationally, and that its true purpose was to initiate what I call the war for technocracy. So what we're in fact looking at here is not so much to do with public health, which I think is largely a decoy, but actually a deep state military operation.
Who is this deep state?
Yeah, that's something I get into in my next book, which will come out on the 4th of June. That will be called Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State. We did an interview on the article which led to this book a year or so ago. The book is much more extensive and elaborates the parallels between the political economy of 1930s Germany in the pre-war years and the political economy of the West since 2020. So it's my view that there is a deliberate attempt taking place to collapse liberal democracy and replace it with a novel form of totalitarianism, which is biodigital technocracy.
Yes, but if you or I were wandering down Oxford Street, maybe drifting towards Piccadilly, that sort of area, where will we find the deep state? Who are these people? Where are they?
Well, in my opinion, we're dealing with the upper echelons of finance capital in particular. When you read my book, and it constructs a genealogy of the origins of this transnational deep state, and you can trace it back primarily to Anglo-American finance capital from the early part of the 20th century. So I would be looking, for example, to big names such as Rockefeller, Carnegie, DuPont, Ford, etc., which over time have, through their philanthropic foundations, served to socially engineer society, have worked hand in glove with the intelligence agencies to stage false flag operations, among other things. Of course, it's in the very nature of what they do that they try to remain invisible and secret as far as possible. That said, certain kind of powerful actors are of course well known. I mean, the deep state, you know, it will include, for example, the head of Goldman Sachs. It will include public figures like Schwab and Gates. Some of these figureheads are there on purpose. But the really powerful actors behind the scenes, I think, are the ones that ultimately control finance capitalism, and with it can pull the levers of society.
Yeah, before we get into this whole idea of psychological warfare, psychological operations, which this book is about, what do you make of there seems to have been an absolutely enormous turnaround in ownership and wealth, and a principle which many of us, you know, older of us were brought up with in, you know, the 1960s and the 1970s, even into the 80s a little bit, of equality of opportunity, home ownership, and the idea that society was there to make sure that everybody at least had a little slice of the cake, even if they didn't have a big chunk. That all seems to have changed in the last 30 years or so, David, where, for example, with the COVID pandemic, we had a massive transfer of wealth to the rich. And it now seems as if many of our political institutions are actually run and controlled and owned by the rich. We've got price fixing going on in energy markets and many other markets too. We're told that We're very sorry that Thames Water is going bust. We're going to have to refinance it, jack up everybody's bills rather than renationalise it. So can you just tell us a bit about this context, maybe connected with the privatisation and globalisation that's led to people owning less and less? And actually, we're in this terrific situation now where work is often no longer a route out of poverty. So even when you get into work, you get yourself a decent job, you're still having to claim benefits in order to pay the bills.
Absolutely correct. I get into this in both of the books in different places. What we're dealing here with is five decades of neoliberal economics. In the book on psychological operations, chapter one, I cite the Global Inequality Report from 2022. And it presents some quite startling evidence that shows, for example, you mentioned the last 30 years. Well, roughly in that period, of all of the wealth which has been generated globally, something like 38% of it has been creamed off by the richest 1% of the global population. And an even higher, it goes up exponentially. The closer you get to the top 1%, the top 0.1%, the top 0.001%, and so on. So there's been this tremendous concentration of wealth among a very small group of people numerically. Now, meanwhile, when you look at the data for instance, the minimum wage in the United States since 1960s, once you adjust for inflation, it's barely gone up at all. So for most ordinary people, living standards haven't improved at all under neoliberalism. And with the pandemic, in inverted commas, this really was an assault on the working classes and on the middle classes. Again, this is something which has been going on in some ways since 2008 with the era of austerity. The middle classes have also come increasingly into this. But there was a global wealth transfer of something like $3 trillion from the lower and middle classes to the upper classes. And again, all the evidence is set out in chapter one of this book. So in my opinion, what we are dealing with fundamentally in all of this is a global class war in which the richest 1% or so of the global population, you might want to extrapolate that to the top 10%, which controls roughly half the world's wealth. Maybe there are certain layers below that that see their interests as best served by aligning with the ruling class. But at any rate, it's a relatively low percentage of the global population that sees its position now at risk. The global population itself has risen from approximately 1.5 billion in 1950 to approximately 8 billion today. So that's more than a fivefold increase. It's very difficult to control a population of that size. And after 15, 20 years of austerity, a lot of people are really feeling the pinch. They were before 2020. So, for example, in 2019, there were mass protests in 35 different countries. That's one in five countries around the world were witnessing mass protests. So you might think back to the yellow vests, for example, in France on the streets every week, every weekend for over a year, mass protests in places like India and Chile. So we know that there are enormous levels of social discontent for obvious economic reasons. And I think what happened in 2020 is that the transnational ruling class, which controls what I call the transnational deep state, took the decision that previous paradigms of control, particularly as we've seen since 1945, are no longer fit for purpose. Giorgio Agamben makes this point very nicely, and that a new paradigm of control is needed. And that paradigm is global technocracy, which its potential for human enslavement is truly frightening, but that's what they're attempting.
So you're looking at COVID particularly, but this whole idea of a psychological operation, is it fair to say this is just another word for deception? The idea is that agendas are rolling out, policies are being promulgated, discussed, approved of, and actually there's something else going on beneath the surface.
It goes far deeper than deception. My book is 8 chapters long, and only one chapter, chapter 6, is on deception and the extent of the lies. There are another 7 chapters in that book, and this is only volume 1. I intend to write volume 2 if I can. So in addition to deception, what I discuss in this book are techniques, for example, of shock and stress, of trauma-based mind control, of the use of fear and threat, cognitive attacks, mass paranoia and hysteria, and dividing the population and turning it against itself. One of the points I'm keen to stress in the book is that the complexity of this psychological operation is such that it must have taken many years of deliberate planning and has clearly drawn, in my opinion, on all kinds of techniques learned from an array of sources in the past, ranging from the Tavistock Institute to Pavlovian experiments in the Soviet Union, to CIA mind control programs, to cult indoctrination, and many other things besides. And what's so frightening about it is that when you look at the evidence carefully, it would appear that very dark actors behind the scenes have been planning this for some time, and then they unleashed all of it at once to create the kind of maximum shock in 2020. And this is why so many people are still reeling from the impact of this. It goes much deeper and much further than we might at first think.
So, yeah, lots and lots of layers of deception. What I'm trying to ask you about is that, I mean, obviously at the surface at the pandemic, which I think you quite rightly put inverted commas around, ostensibly this was a global, let's just pick it apart a little bit, a global alarm of a virus. And one of the main questions about all of this, of course, is whether or not it was man-made. Now, a lot of even the UK so-called parliamentary inquiry into this is prohibiting anybody even looking at that. So I wonder whether these sorts of aspects of it are being deliberately kept from people. So at the end of the day, I think what it's important to do is to try and make some sort of connection between what we have been told about COVID-19 and what the actual effect this is having on another level. So what's the real purpose behind it is what I'm trying to ask you.
It's a giant smokescreen to initiate the war for technocracy. So what they're trying to do is to move us on to, for example, central bank digital currencies, smart cities, smart technologies whereby everybody and everything can be connected to a technocratic control grid. This involves potentially biotechnologies, bio-nanotechnologies going into the body. I discuss this in chapter 8 of the book. If that can be achieved, if this invisible bio-digital architecture of human enslavement is allowed to reach maturity, this could permanently mark the end of human freedom. It could potentially be irreversible. It's a form of scientific dictatorship, as has been dreamt of for a good 100 years or so. So this is the very dark aspect of this. Now, of course, a confident, healthy, free-thinking, strong population would never stand for any of this. So what the psychological operation was intended to do was to leave the population demoralized, disoriented, and debilitated, and thus less able to resist and less able to fight back. It's really quite gruesome.
One of your chapters is called Cognitive Attack. And I think it's, you know, it's fascinating to be able to read about the, you know, these techniques used. But I mean, as I understand it, you know, cognition is, you know, the idea that you're understanding what's going on around you. What is the cognitive attack? How do you identify a cognitive attack when it's happening to you?
Well, it's very difficult when it's happening to you. This is all about breaking down human beings' ability to make sense of the world around them. It fits within the context of what Joost Merlo in 1956 in his book Menticide, The Rape of the Mind, outlines. So, for example, confusion was weaponized in all kinds of ways in 2020, 2021. There was this enormous proliferation of nonsensical and ever-changing rules, in inverted commas, that everyone was expected to follow. There were repeated last-minute U-turns on key government decisions. The restrictions themselves were very unpredictable. Government behavior seemed really quite irrational. There was all kinds of mixed messaging in verbal communications. Words and phrases were kind of twisted to mean their opposites. So, for example, in Australia, there was a slogan, staying apart keeps us together. And all of these things really kind of addle the mind. They make the world seem a very kind of confusing and surreal environment. And furthermore, anybody, well, not everybody, but certain key figures who did speak out against this were thrown into psychiatric institutions. And this is a model which was developed in the Soviet Union, the political abuse of psychiatry, in order to pathologize dissent. So there were a number of key people to whom this happened. And again, all of this has the effect of driving the public mad. The idea that if you're speaking the truth, then you are in fact mad. And if you go along with the madness, somehow you're sane. So you see, everything is back to front. And this is profoundly harmful from a psychological perspective.
Well, it certainly sounds it. It sounds also a little bit Orwellian, don't you think, as well? Maybe George Orwell was... because he obviously was a bit of an insider. He went to Eton. He was working at the BBC World Service, from which he very honourably resigned, saying that it was pointless, the propaganda that the British were trying to put out through him to India. Isn't it a bit Orwellian?
It is, and I do cite Orwell in a few places in the book. But it might be even worse than Orwell. There's a line in 1984, I forget exactly how it goes, but it talks about how the only thing that you still have any real control or sovereignty over is that kind of, I think he calls it like a square cubic centimeter within your own brain. That's the only thing that they can't get at. But of course today, with the kinds of technologies which are coming online, through neuroscience, even that is under threat. So what they are seeking here is total control. This is why it's totalitarianism. They want total control over people's minds, their bodies, their brains, their movements, their behaviors. And they are waging war against populations through every means conceivable. I call it an omni-war in the book. The idea is to keep it concealed as far as possible so that as many people as possible don't understand what's going on. But across every realm of life now, I discuss the psychological warfare in the book, but there's also information warfare, of course, in the journalistic and media space. There's economic warfare of the kind that you've essentially described, of tremendous financial pressures now being brought to bear across the population, and many other forms as well. And all of them are being deployed at once as part of this war for technocracy.
Well, it's amazing. It's almost as if the battle that people, our previous generations, fought in the 1940s against the fascists have resurfaced under a different guise. Would you agree?
Yes, and today's guise is even worse than anything that Hitler or Stalin could have imagined in terms of the potential for social control. And if your listeners want to understand how any of this is possible, I would recommend buying a copy of my book in June when it comes out, or the hard copy in the UK in July, Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State, because it explains that none of this is accidental, and that actually totalitarianism has long been seen as the most efficient and brutal way of crushing the working class. It was backed by Wall Street in the Soviet Union, in Nazi Germany. And we mustn't forget as well the so-called business plot in 1933 in the United States, backed by very wealthy industrialists and financiers. Had that been successful, had it not been foiled by its intended leader, General Smedley Butler, then the United States too could have turned fascist in the 1930s. And the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany and the United States on a totalitarian model, it probably would have been extremely difficult to defeat totalitarianism. So the desire was always there. And we've gone through a long and convoluted historical process now. But really, since 2020, we are seeing the overt reemergence of totalitarianism, but in a novel technocratic form. And the other thing that I argue in my upcoming book is that totalitarianism does not spring fully formed into existence overnight. So are we yet at the kind of worst stage of Nazi Germany? No, we're not, because it's a process which builds over many years. But what I do in Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State is to draw out many of the parallels and continuities between what's taking place in the West today and what took place in 1930s Germany, and to really sound the alarm that there is a historical trajectory at work here, and that it's deliberate, that there are perpetrators and instigators crafting all of this from very powerful positions. And we know where totalitarianism led to in Nazi Germany. We know what the outcomes were. And again, I discuss those at the end of that book, and note how we are at risk of following a similar historical path today, unless the global technocratic coup that is being attempted can be put down.
So we have we started off by talking about the enormous wealth that's been funneled into the hands of a tiny elite over the last 30 years or so. Maybe these people have got a bit too much time on their hands, and certainly too much money. They've been employing that money, it seems, in order to see about, look at ways of hanging on to their power and building their power. It's obviously very kind of dark. But what about this concept of the technocracy? Because I think I first really heard the term back in the noughties, when we had lots of technocrats, chancellors appointed around in the EU countries. The idea was that the best thing to do was just bring an individual in from the private sector to run the public finances in places like Italy and Greece and Spain and France. You know, that public sector people were the wrong kind of people to be running our economies, this kind of thing. So when you talk about technocracy, this is really the idea of the employment of technology. Now, it makes me think of the old 18th century Enlightenment and the idea that, well, we need technology. You know, this is basically the Industrial Revolution after following the Agricultural Revolution, the idea that, you know, we need a kind of technology to free people up. And of course, it was incredibly revolutionary, building ships, you know, the cotton mills, the use of energy, coal, particularly to the dark satanic mills, they called it, didn't they, when this all started. So can you just say what you make of this idea of a new Enlightenment, but the technology, as in those days, of course, they had Luddites. They criticized it, the people, when they saw these new factories coming along. They didn't like it at all. And so could you compare what's going on now with technology? You're talking about, you know, even neuroscience getting into people's brains with that 18th century Enlightenment.
What's taking place today is the opposite of Enlightenment. The Western Enlightenment was also synonymous with the birth of political modernity, the rights of citizenship, several centuries of Republican and liberal thinking, all of which was oriented towards human freedom. What we're seeing today is the tail end of that process, and it's all going into reverse. And so as Agamben perceived in the late 90s, in fact, this kind of 2 or 3 century old paradigm of rule and social organization in the West would eventually give way to a more direct form of control, which he calls biopolitics, whereby the state assumes control directly over human bodies. Now, you talk about technology. It's not as simple as just the technology itself. We also have to keep in mind the class relations behind this and who is developing and using the technology and to what end. So you're quite right that during the Enlightenment, technological progress held out enormous potential for the betterment of human society. The idea, very broadly, was that progress in politics and morality would go hand in hand with progress in science and technology. Of course, all of that came to a crashing halt with the Battle of the Somme and World War I and mass mechanized slaughter and so on. But fundamentally, that idea is a sound one, that in principle, technology could be used for the betterment of human society. If we can have machines taking over a lot of the work, in principle, that could be a good thing because it could lead to more leisure time for everybody. But in practice, it's being used for World Economic Forum purposes. And we have demons like Yuval Noah Harari talking about the coming useless class who will be put out of work and won't have any real function. And of course, when you extrapolate the logic of that, you quickly get into eugenics and culling the herd and so on. And it all becomes very dark and ugly. But technocracy as an idea, or perhaps an ideology, actually goes back to the 1930s. It was dreamt up in the halls of Columbia University. And the point of it was originally, in the context of the Great Depression, to formulate an alternative to the unpredictable booms and busts of capitalism, whereby price is determined by supply and demand. And an alternative system was proposed, technocracy, whereby everything should be priced according to the energy cost of its production and usage. And what this essentially was an early vision of the scientific management of society. Now, what they originally argued was precisely in keeping with this idea that this should in fact create more leisure time for everyone, that this should be a superior system. However, the technologies were not available in the 1930s for delivering this kind of a system. They are today. They go under the name SMART, which allows everybody and everything to be monitored in real time, and for the technocrats at the top of the system to have access to all of this data and to be able to monitor and surveil everything. But those original kind of technocratic ideas by the mid-20th century were already being twisted into ideas about a scientific dictatorship, to quote Aldous Huxley. Bertrand Russell was coming out with similar ideas as the big new Brzezinski in his concept of what he called the technotronic era in the 1970s. These are all very similar kinds of projects aimed at a scientific dictatorship. And then from that point on, what we find is the Rockefellers investing large sums of money into China from the 1970s on, particularly in terms of research and development. And in that regard, it seems no accident that China has become what Ian Davis calls the world's first technate. And I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with the Chinese social credit scoring system and the kind of high levels of surveillance in that society, epitomized, of course, during the lockdowns in, I think it was early 2022 in Shanghai, where that enormous city was locked down. No one was allowed to leave their apartment blocks, and a drone would ominously pass by, blaring the message, "Control your soul's desire for freedom." So this is the kind of dystopian nightmare that this is now all threatening to turn into. And I think what we've seen since 2020 is that Chinese models for technocratic control are now to be rolled out in the West. And that will, as I say, mark the end of three centuries of Western liberalism.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it. This is, as you say, a bit dark, and I would use the word evil. It's not a word I've heard you use so far, but there is an element of organized evil here. I wonder whether you would agree.
I absolutely would agree. I do use the word in the book. The category of evil is something which certainly in academia, it was kind of marginalized really in the second half of the 20th century amongst ideas about secularization and modernization and projections that there'd be no further need for religion in the future. But when you're looking at a project that has involved lying to everybody, deliberately traumatizing them, psychologically torturing them, deliberately inflicting maximum amounts of stress and shock through a shock and awe operation, keeping them held in a state of fear, if not terror, deliberately scrambling their brains, finding mechanisms for dividing society through the production of mass paranoia and hysteria, complex techniques of indoctrination, hypnosis and programming. And all of this is so that you can enslave the global population through biodigital technologies. I can't think of any other way to describe that than evil.
I mean, one would have thought that the churches, other similar institutions might have taken the gloves off in the face of this. Is there any evidence that any of them have?
No, the opposite's true. And again, I have a little section about this in the book Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State in chapter two. One of the remarkable features of 1930s Germany was what was known as Gleichschaltung, which broadly translates as the production of ideological conformity. And there was a tremendous failure among all the professions, really, to challenge this ideological conformity. So we saw it, for example, in academia. After the war, many German scholars described how academia had, in their words, prostituted itself before Nazi power. We saw it in terms of the churches, the Concordat with the Vatican being the best known example. We saw it with the failure of the political left to unite and provide sufficient challenge to the Nazis. And we're seeing similar processes playing out again today. So where has academia been since 2020? What has it had to say about these very dark and nefarious processes that are taking place? Very little. It's had plenty to offer in terms of helping those processes along. It feeds into the so-called counter misinformation industry. It provides algorithms to help Twitter censor things more effectively. Legal scholars have sought to provide justifications for mandatory vaccination. So academia's complicity in this is extraordinary. Again, the left has, the political left has really not done anything to stand up against this. And the churches, again, when we look at, for example, Justin Welby, he came out with such remarks as Jesus would have got vaccinated or something along those lines. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So as in the 1930s, we have seen a decline, shall we say, in civilization, whereby academics are fundamentally not speaking the truth. Doctors are not following the Hippocratic Oath. The left is not supporting the working class. The churches are not doing enough to protect their faith. It's really quite extraordinary what is happening. It has to be reversed.
These people have become institutionalized and more interested in keeping their jobs than actually doing them. I mean, I think that's and by the way, the media, I have to chip in here, exactly the same. They have really utterly failed to do their job in disentangling this for the general public. But look, there's another aspect to all of this, which is this kind of takeover by the computers of life generally and decisions in society. And we're seeing this sort of thing going on, particularly over in Gaza in the Middle East, with many people suggesting, quite rightly in my view, that many of the crimes being committed there against civilians, children, hospitals, schools, would not be done if a human being was behind the trigger. And so there are AI systems now doing targeting for the genocide going on there. And I wonder, this seems to be the aim for the whole of society, that computers are controlling cities like they're almost people farms, you know. So, and if anybody starts to get out of line, you know, this very kind of dystopian way, a drone will come and just take them out, you know, because this sort of thing can't be allowed. But I mean, this vision, this dream of the elite, super rich, that they can control the whole of the world or even individual countries through computers making decisions, is it possible?
That all depends on the class conflict. It all depends on whether populations are going to put up with this and accept it. The outcome is determined in the struggle. So, of course, they've been very clever about the way they've done all of this. The advent of social media, for example, and getting everybody hooked on Facebook and Twitter, etc. The notifications are designed to kind of trigger dopamine hits by design, so that they're chemically addictive as well. And everybody is on these platforms. Everybody's sharing their data. And, you know, I mean, it's bad enough in and of itself, in terms of the kind of mental health damage that's done. But the problem is, you can, you know, you talk about drones. You can use similar principles to, for example, marketing. If you want to market on social media, you need to find out kind of who the key influencers are, the key nodes, and then you target them, and they then kind of feed down. But it's true also, you know, if you're dealing with alleged terrorist networks and so on, if you have all of this data to hand, it's extremely easy to target key people and to take them out. And all of this is done in a clinical, completely detached manner. We're seeing drones now, the advent of drones, which are fully autonomous, to avoid, for example, problems of radar jamming. But what the autonomous drone phenomenon means is that increasingly the kill decision is actually being left to a robot. The AI is used to decide who to kill. So there's real problems with accountability here and plausible deniability and so on. So these technologies which have been developed, unfortunately, are being used for evil because they are in the wrong hands. They need to be expropriated from the ruling class and put in service of the rest of humanity.
But isn't there a sort of inevitability to this as the technology increases? It's almost like the nuclear weapons. When that's developed, it's going to be used, and at some point in the future may well be again. Isn't there an inevitability to the development of this technology, the acquisition of it by an elite to subsume the rest of the population and to enslave people?
Well, that's a technological determinist argument, which kind of suggests that technology will kind of always kind of keep developing by itself and will fundamentally drive developments in warfare and within the rest of society. I would propose instead that there's nothing natural or organic about the development of these technologies. Huge amounts of money are thrown at them by the ruling class for particular ends. So, I mean, if we talk about nuclear weapons, one way of looking at that is to say, well, this has kind of marked the kind of logical extreme of many centuries of warfare, where the weapons have become ever more destructive and ever more technologically sophisticated, to an extent where if you're still thinking in terms of the old paradigms of World War, such as World War One and World War Two, you really can't have a World War III of the same nature that would involve nuclear weapons, because everybody would die essentially. However, I mean, this has been known since the mid 20th century. And as I argue in the book on psychological operations, the war is not merely fought horizontally between nation states. At a more fundamental level, it is fought vertically between classes. And it has been clear to the ruling classes of all countries since the mid-20th century, and particularly since 1968, that their position is in jeopardy unless they can combine and organize and find ways of keeping the global population in check. And ultimately, this was always going to come to a global class war. The logic has been in place for decades now. Of course, for the general population, it's only now that they're starting to wake up and understand this. But how do you control a global population? Well, it can't be done with missiles and nuclear weapons and so on. It has to be done through other means and new forms of technology. And therefore, it's no accident that since around the year 2000, at least, there has been a huge push towards bio-nanotechnologies, which are nanotechnology is a millionth of a meter. It's so tiny. And these are technologies which can go within the body and communicate with external networks. So phenomenal amounts of money have been thrown at these projects. The R&D has been ongoing for some two decades. I have a four-part series coming out at the moment in Propaganda in Focus on transhumanism, co-authored with Lisa Johnson and Dan Brody, in which we go through some of the military intelligence documents from the last couple of decades, which again lend great credence to the fact that behind the scenes, the military has been deliberately working very, very hard on this kind of technology. Because if you can successfully achieve a kind of biodigital control over human bodies, that is total social control. If you can monitor humans down to the level of their organs, if you can surveil them at all times and know what, you know, where they are and so on, there's potential here for remote control assassination, remote control torture. It's so gruesome that the possibilities hardly bear thinking about. But you know, we know, for example, that they developed, I refer to this in chapter 8 of the book, the remote control beetle, where they could just activate and control all the legs of the beetle remotely. Now, these kinds of technologies exist. And again, if you can, you know, if you can get these kinds of things into human bodies, human bloodstreams, and indeed human brains, you know, we are looking at a complete totalitarian nightmare here. But again, people don't see it. They imagine that these technologies are being developed for noble and good purposes. So the way they're marketed, for example, often has to do with potential cures for Parkinson's or for cancer. And I think what many researchers who are helping to develop these technologies don't understand is that they could also be dual-use technologies, and that they could be used by very dark actors for extremely nefarious purposes.
So is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, there is. And again, it has to do with class conflict and class consciousness, for that matter. So, you know, what is sometimes referred to as the Great Awakening. You know, really what that means is the kind of collapse of the power of the Western propaganda system to control the minds of the population as effectively as it once did. I would see this in terms of a growing form of class consciousness, that more and more people realize now the kinds of agendas which are being deployed against them across all areas of life. And of course, once you see these things, you can't unsee them. There's no going back. So what that means is that over time, incrementally, the numbers on our side are going up and up and up. Now, they might not be as great as we would like at this stage. But one example I sometimes give has to do with the number of people in the number of adults in the UK who refused to take a so-called COVID-19 vaccine. So if you look at the official data from the UK Health Security Agency from July 2022, by which time that injection campaign had mostly run its course, 23% of UK adults at that time had refused the shot altogether. Now, we know that official statistics were heavily massaged at every point during the so-called pandemic. So it's likely that the figure is much higher than 23%. I don't know how much higher, but you know, we could be looking at a third of the population potentially that kind of feels or intuits or simply recognizes that something is very, very badly wrong at this point. When you look at it like that, the balance of forces is, in fact, quite fine. For sure, there will probably always be maybe, I don't know, 10 or 20% of the population who will remain permanently hypnotized for whatever reason. Some people are just totally susceptible to the propaganda. And of course, the ferocity of the psychological operation that was waged against us was designed precisely to make people more susceptible to the propaganda.
Yeah, well, I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but there is this sort of herd instinct, isn't it? There are many, many people out there just don't want to stand out in the crowd.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it, for sure. But again, when you read commentators from Nazi Germany, you know, I cite some of them in the Wall Street Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State book. You know, they were saying things back then like, you just don't know. how many people are really on board with all of this, because too many people are frightened to say anything. And even those people who do zealously and outspokenly follow the official line, you can't even be sure that they really believe what they're saying, because they probably know that there's something really, really wrong here as well. So in other words, there's a great deal of unknowns here. It's not clear what proportion of the population is really kind of starting to understand what's happening here. And of course, one of the ways the propaganda works is to constantly try and make us feel as though we are a fringe group or a minority group. So you may remember the odious Andrew Neil a year or two ago, laying into the 5 million unvaccinated, as he called them. But again, that number was, even by official statistics, it was way higher than 5 million. Or take all of the opinion polls conducted by Gallup and YouGov and so on. They're all so evidently massaged and manipulated and fake. The results are completely implausible, but they are designed again to make the public believe that, you know, a large majority of people is in favor of the measures, and that therefore they should, to use your phrase, go with the herd. This is all very psychologically manipulative. Mm. But again, if we actually just dig down and look at some of the concrete data, we can work out that there is a sizable part of the population which is firmly against this.
So it might well be people watching TV, listening to the radio, reading the newspapers, and thinking they're going with the herd, when actually they are not. They're going off a cliff somewhere because they're too trusting in the media. I wonder, before we round up, David, it's I think useful for people to know, because you've obviously done a lot of reading around this subject, of particular writers, broadcasters, maybe bloggers that you think are worth checking out. Because I interviewed Kees van der Peil a few weeks ago, who's come out with this, I think, tremendous book, States of Emergency: Keeping the Global Population in Check, which I've nearly finished reading, which has just got some unbelievable stuff in there about the plandemic. I think let's just agree to call it that for now. So just wonder if you could give us a sort of maybe your a few of your top tips for individuals to, you know, to read their stuff and to follow, but potentially just to get up to speed with this, because it's complicated, isn't it? And a lot of us actually do enjoy reading.
Yeah, it is. It is very complicated. Okay, so yeah, I mean, van der Peil's book I cite extensively in my own book. So yeah, fully on board with that recommendation. Kees van der Peil, States of Emergency, Clarity Press, 2022. I would also recommend the writings of Simon Elmer. He's produced three books now in the context of the COVID era, and he gets it. He understands full well what's going on in terms of the building of the biosecurity state and the nascent global form of totalitarianism that is starting to appear all around us. CJ Hopkins, he gets it in the context of Nazi Germany. He lives in Berlin, and he fully has understood the parallels here to the point of facing prosecution in the law courts for his writings about this. Vera Shirav, the Holocaust survivor, has produced a brilliant documentary series, five parts long at the moment. Part six will be coming out this year, I understand, called Never Again Is Now Global. She too understands what's happening here. Part of that Never Again Is Now Global team involves a guy called Uwe Alschner in Germany. He has a Substack blog which is very, very good. In terms of some of the necessary context for understanding this before COVID, the writings of Douglas Valentine I think are extremely valuable. Anyone else that I've missed off the list? I'm sure there is. Ian Davis. Well,
look, I'm going to pick you up on you used the term transhumanism, and I think for a lot of people, we struggle to come to terms with these new terms sometimes. And could you just sum it up? What you think it means in a nutshell?
Yeah, well, the best place for this would be to look at part one of the four-part transhumanism series that we have out in Propaganda in Focus at the moment. We talk there about the problems of defining transhumanism, because for many people, they kind of have this image of something that's kind of slightly geeky or wacky or kind of sci-fi or unreal. You know, you think about the writings of Ray Kurzweil and the coming singularity, etc., and we're going to be able to upload our brains into the cloud and all of this kind of thing, and it just seems, some of it seems ridiculous frankly. However, the point that we're making in our four-part series here is that that kind of image is very useful for whitewashing or decoying a much more sinister dimension here, and we're focusing on the military intelligence aspect of transhumanism. So again, the way it's marketed is often in positive terms. They talk about, for example, upgrading or augmenting human beings. Now, these are positive sounding terms that would lead us to want to embrace these kinds of technologies. But as I've already explained, the problem is that once you start fusing the kinds of technologies we're dealing with here with human bodies, actually, the potential for social control is absolutely gigantic. And to be frank, we simply can't trust the people who are trying to do this. And again, we've seen a widespread abandonment of medical ethics since 2020, the first do no harm principle out the window, informed consent out the window, coerced injection of billions of people instead. So this is a dark era that we are currently living through. And I think that transhumanism is all part of the way of trying to sell these technologies to us.
Well, I think the light side of it comes from linking up with people like you, David. You know? I mean, surely this concept, transhumanism, is pretty simple, really. The idea is that our human bodies aren't really good enough and we should upgrade them by plugging ourselves into something for an upgrade.
Yeah, I mean, that's how they want us to think about this. And I mean, you know, I find it very difficult to deal with, because there should be great potential for good in these technologies. So, you know, for example, I have a son with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And these kinds of technologies, you know, in principle, if they could be used to help with these, you know, very, very serious conditions, should be welcomed and applauded. But the problem is, I just don't trust the people that are developing them. I don't trust their motives. I don't trust their designs. And, you know, for many people, is it the case that we need upgrading? You know, what happened to the idea of being fearfully and wondrously made? Now, who says that we need upgrading?
What about the idea that you could, for example, change someone's DNA so that your children will live forever?
Well, is that possible? I mean, again, I look at transhumanism as just the latest iteration of eugenics. It's simply eugenics. You know, when you're talking about, you know, messing with people's DNA, and again, there's all kinds of evidence now emerging about, you know, potential DNA plasmids and so on in the vaccines. And you know, so God knows what effect the vaccines may be having genetically. We simply don't know at this stage. But again, you know, when Klaus Schwab talks about designer babies and so on, we're dealing here with eugenics. Let's not beat around the bush. And we've seen the history of eugenics.
This is happening now in the UK, the US and Israel, most definitely already happening, designer babies happening. Anyway, your book is COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War of Technocracy, obviously, or for Technocracy. obviously the publishers, Springer International, aren't quite subsumed into the Borg yet. Can you just give us a roundup of some of those other titles you were talking about, David?
Right. So if your listeners do a search for the phrase War for Technocracy, that normally brings up the book for a free download as the first search result. It's worth just noting that I was able to secure £14,000 of open access funding for this book, which goes straight to the publisher. But what it means is that the book is freely available to download and redistribute, and that can be done legally under a Creative Commons 4.0 license. So please do download it. Please do share it as widely as you can. You can get the whole thing either in a single PDF document or individual chapters. Please do email it around as much as anything else, because, of course, it's being shadow banned quite fiercely on social media. The flip side of this is that I don't earn a penny in terms of royalties or fees or anything. So, for example, the hard copy of the book is available on Amazon and it costs £109.99. Every single penny of that goes to the publisher. So what I would request readers to do is, if you do download it and if you do think that there is something here of value in my work, please do consider supporting my work financially and giving something back. This has been 3 years of very hard intellectual and emotional labor to produce this book. It's also put my career at risk. There's a round of redundancies taking place at my institution at the moment. And I think it's quite likely that I will be one of the cuts. So I'm looking at a difficult year ahead as I try and rebuild my career or find something else to do. So I do need all the support I can get. As I mentioned earlier, this is just volume one of the book. I have started volume two. I know exactly where I want to go with that. But I can really only write that book at this stage with the public's support going forward. So I mean, a very simple way at the moment of making a modest one-off donation is buymeacoffee.com/DA Hughes. If you check out my academia.edu website, which is ulincoln, all one word, ulincoln.academia.edu/David Hughes/papers. You'll find a document in there called Support My Work, which lays out various other ways in which you might be able to support me. I'm also starting a Substack at this stage, dhughes.substack.com. That should be getting off the ground fairly soon. So again, if you find something of value in my work and want me to keep going doing this kind of work, please consider taking out a paid subscription to that. I'd also plug a website. I'm going to get my own website off the ground, hopefully fairly soon. That will be www.omniwar.org. So, thanks in advance to anyone who might be able to support this work.
And could you just review, you mentioned a couple of other books that you've done there as well, David.
Okay, so the key book was the COVID-19 Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy. The second book is forthcoming on the 4th of June. I think the Kindle version will be available. That is published with Skyhorse. It's called Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State. I think there's some really important new material in that book regarding the continuities and the parallels between 1930s Germany and the West since 2020. That's not freely available. I wasn't able to get the publisher to agree to an open access deal there, but nevertheless, that book is considerably cheaper than the Paul Grove Macmillan book. So it's reasonably priced. I think it's something like 5 or 10% or something of each copy on that. So it's not huge, but again, if you can purchase a copy, it would it would help me out. So, as I say, Propaganda in Focus at the moment is the place to go for the four-part series on transhumanism. So that's where I'm at, and that's where I hope to go.
Well, I suppose we better look out for you on Substack, David Hughes. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on, Tony.